Wind west at 6, 47 degrees Kenosha, 46 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really excited that we can spend most of today talking about a very, very important play, one that I have a bit of personal connection with. It was during COVID-19, when so much was shut down in the performing arts, that the Racine Theater Guild undertook a virtual presentation, if you will, of this play called The Laramie Project, springing from the tragic, brutal murder of Matthew Shepard in Laramie, Wyoming, back in 1998, and a play which sought to bring to light the feelings and attitudes of the ordinary people in Laramie, Wyoming, reacting to what had occurred to Matthew Shepard, trying to make sense of it. And the Laramie Project now is about to be presented at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And I'm very happy to have with me on the morning show to talk about it Fabrice Conte-Williamson, who is now chair of the theater department at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and directing this production, the performances of which will be occurring this coming weekend and the following weekend as well. Fabrice Conte-Williamson, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Hi, good morning. It's good to be here.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. I kind of neglected to say, but in that virtual production of the Laramie Project, I had a small role as one of the professors at the local university where Matthew Shepard was a student, and my wife Kathy had a role in that as well, as did a whole lot of people from the Theater Guild and the outside community. And I counted among one of the most powerful experiences of my life to have been a part of that. And so I am exceptionally excited by the opportunity to see Parkside's production over the course of these next two weekends. Tell us, first of all, about the decision to do this play and how it sort of folds into the overall season. I guess maybe part of what I'm asking is kind of how the overall season at a place like Parkside gets put together.
Yeah, so we choose our season about a year in advance, trying to plan for opportunities for students. We knew we were going to get a really big incoming class of students. It's our biggest class ever, in fact. Hmm. So we needed a production that was pretty flexible in terms of the number of opportunities for student actors. And the Laramie Project, you know, as you know very well, has a large number of characters. The cast is quite flexible. You can double cast a lot of these people. In fact, that's the whole premise of the show, that actors play multiple roles. So it felt like a good fit. And from a content point of view, you know, it was important to us when we looked at relevant shows that this year marks the 25th anniversary of Matthew's murder. Mm. And there are a lot of events around the country about that anniversary and the legacy of Matthew's murder and his parents' advocacy for LGBTQ rights. So it felt like a good fit for us. I had the opportunity to direct this show at the University of Oklahoma many years ago, and as you very justly point out, it's a really important story to tell, and it's a very emotional and intense experience for the entire creative team who works on this show because of the content and the way it's so beautifully put together and written. So when the title came up, I was just excited to be able to work on this show again and kind of have a new, different experience with the students and the faculty at UW Parkside.
Hmm. I had not done the math, so it had not occurred to me that it is exactly a quarter century ago that that this event took place. And I suspect the vast majority of people listening to this interview will know at least something about the story of Matthew Shepard and what befell him. But for the sake of anybody listening who maybe was too young or for whatever reason just is not acquainted with this story, maybe we should take a moment to cover at least the essential basics of who Matthew Shepard was and what happened to him.
Yeah, Matthew Shepard was a student at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. He had just moved there, in fact, from Denver, Colorado, and he was started to work in trying to see for himself a future in political affairs, really. And so he was just a brand new student in Laramie. He encountered two young men at a bar one night, and that they left together, we know that much, and later was found tied to a fence, beaten up really severely on the outskirts of Laramie. And Matthew died a few days later in the hospital from his injuries. And so that moment marked a really big turning point, I think, in LGBTQ history in the United States. A sad one, very similar to what happened to Harvey Milk. Mm. This sort of violence kind of brought to the forefront of the conversation, you know, the place of hate, the idea of hate crimes. So it's a terrible story. It's a very sad story, but the interest of the Laramie Project is that it really goes beyond telling the story of Matthew Shepard, because as you mentioned earlier, it's about the community, really, the community of Laramie and the portrayal of the community and how the community deals with grief, with hope, with moving forward, with acknowledging what happens and healing. And that, I think, is universal. It speaks to everybody, you know.
So tell our listeners about this gentleman named Moises Kaufman, whose name appears at sort of the head of the script, and the story of how this script took shape. It's, of course, a very unconventional way, an intriguing way to create a script.
Yeah. Moises Kaufman is an actor and director who works in New York. He is the head of a company called Tectonic Theater Project, who is still active today. And what happened in 98 is Tectonic decided as a group to travel to Laramie after the event to interview community members. And from these interviews, they pieced together, they edited the interviews, they assembled them. And they created the script for the play. So everything in the play is based on these interviews. And it's what we call verbatim theater, which is a tradition in theater making. And the essential work that Tectonic Theater does is verbatim theater. They employ a technique called moment work. So the play, instead of being divided into scenes, is divided into moments. We were very lucky because we're expecting to host a talk back with Scott Barrow, who's one of the members of Tectonic, following the first Sunday matinee on October 15th. So immediately after the performance, this is open to the community. In the theater, Scott will be with us to talk about the work that Tectonic does and how they approach theater making in an unconventional way, you know.
Mm. We're speaking with Fabrice Conte-Williamson from the theater department, theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and talking about their production of The Laramie Project, a play created in 2000 by Moises Kaufman and members of the Tectonic Theater Project, an example of what they like to call verbatim theater, in which the script, if you will, springs directly out of the actual words of actual people, in this case some actual people from Laramie, Wyoming, talking about trying to make sense of the tragic fate of Matthew Shepard, who had been murdered just a couple of years before. So explain to someone who has not ever seen the Laramie Project, in a sense, what unspools from start to finish. I mean, when, for instance, the curtain goes up, where are we? When are we?
So the play, because it's a collection of interviews and they're not presented in a chronological order, appears as a form of almost like a puzzle. So you have short snippets from the different interviews that are almost like thrown at you at the beginning of the play, and you hear all these different voices about what happened, what people think happened, how they reacted, their connection to the event. And some people are directly connected to the murder. We hear from the judge, we hear from the police, we hear from the EMS, we hear from Matthew's friends, but also some other members of the community who are not directly related to what happened, but suffer the consequences in many ways and still have to deal with what happened. So for the audience, the interesting experience, in my opinion, is that you get sort of bombarded with a lot of different points of view, and you have to create your own experience. You have to create your own understanding of the events and how to deal with the reality of who we are as a community and how do we move forward. So it's an unconventional theater going experience. We've decided to stage it in an alley theater, which is also unconventional for most audience members. Meaning that you have audiences on two sides of the theater facing each other.
Right. So the couple of times I've seen this, the performance space, if you will, is kind of a long rectangle.
Absolutely.
And then you have against one wall some of the audience, and against the opposite wall other people in the audience, in a sense, looking at each other. Mm-hmm. And before them then is this performance space, like a long bar, if you will.
Exactly. Yeah. Like you said, the audience is looking at each other, which was very important to me. I thought there's an idea in the Laramie Project that this is a way to explore who you are and to kind of scrutinize who you are as a community. And so the fact that the audience is visible to one another, it was kind of interesting and important, I think, to acknowledge that not only you're watching the play, but you're also participating in the play in some way. Mm-hmm. Even though it's pretty passive, you're still there, you're still somewhat visible to the rest of the audience. So we were excited to explore a sort of different way to present theater, because the Laramie Project is a very different kind of play.
One of the things that I'd like to talk with you about is, in terms of, you've already touched on kind of the wide array of citizens of Laramie, Wyoming, who are part of this, from whom we hear. And how would you assess, in a sense, the even-handedness of that portrait of Laramie, Wyoming as a community, in terms of those who are emotionally shattered from the tragedy of Matthew Shepard's murder, all the way to people who maybe thought he had it coming, or in other ways were very much untouched by the tragedy, perhaps didn't see it as a tragedy at all. Along that wide spectrum of possibilities, who do we meet in Laramie, Wyoming, and what sort of overall portrait of the community emerges in this play?
I think where where Moses Kaufman did a great job with his team of playwrights working on the script is that they chose to include such a variety of voices that it is not a play that really tells you how to feel about what happened, but rather presents how so many different people feel. And therefore, you have to make your own sort of decision to deal with the events yourself. So one of my very favorite monologues is from a character and a real person named Sherry, who talks about how she really struggles to understand the media attention that this event has gotten. Because, of course, for those of us who remember what happened in 1998, there was quite a national and even international interest in this murder. She recalls the loss of a police officer who she says worked with her husband. And that monologue is so interesting because it allows, I think, the audience to hear the perspective of somebody who at first we might dismiss, but then we also listen to their own humanity, and we also understand that where they're coming from is equally valid in order, you know, to understand their experience, to understand the community's experience. So I appreciate and I celebrate the fact that Tectonic included so many different points of view, so many different testimonies, and they didn't choose to make the play an advocacy piece, but rather they tried, and I think they succeeded so beautifully, to paint the complexity of the community of Laramie, which I think reflects the complexity of the United States in general.
Absolutely. I quite agree. And another thing that I appreciate about it is, and I think I especially appreciate this aspect of the Laramie Project, because the kind of character I'm about to describe is one of the characters that is one of the characters that my wife portrayed in the Theater Guild's presentation, is that it's very easy to think of this in very binary terms, that you have the people who loved Matthew Shepard and then the people who hated Matthew Shepard. And there is this sharp divide, and you're on one side or the other. And there are plenty of people in Laramie who had maybe complicated feelings, and maybe their feelings about this and Matthew Shepard and what happened to him in sort of shades of gray. And I just appreciate the fact that they weren't afraid of the gray, that it wasn't completely black and white in its portrayal. And in particular, you really saw people where, you know, they'd never really ever stopped to even think about some of these issues and were grappling with them for the very first time. And I guess that's the part that where I mean, I don't think there's a gray area in terms of what happened to Matthew Shepard. It was a despicable, horrific act, and there is no gray about that. But in terms of people trying to take all this in and embrace a new understanding, you have people in kind of all different points along the path. And I really appreciate it that sort of complicated part of all this is not shied away in this play.
Yeah, we have, I think, a responsibility when we put theater together, when we present theater, when we make theater, to acknowledge the complexity of the human experience, right? I think the best plays do that, and the Laramie Project is a great example of that. Of taking on a real event and looking into the humanity in all its complexity, its nuance, and that this is why we I think enjoy going to the theater, is because we get to take a couple of hours and think about who are we and what do we want to be and how can we be a little bit better to one another.
We're speaking with Fabrice Conte-Williamson from the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. He is the director of the Laramie Project, which is going to be opening this coming weekend with performances the next two weekends at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. So to the matter of casting and the fact that as the play is set down on paper, we're talking about more than 60 different characters, and yet most traditionally the Laramie Project is done by a relatively small cast of maybe 8 actors, and I suspect there's some flexibility. I mean, in the case, for instance, of the Theater Guild, there wasn't any of that doubling up because they wanted, for a lot of reasons, to have as many people involved as possible. So you don't have 60-plus actors. You are more adhering towards the kind of the traditional way that the Laramie Project is conceived. So when it comes to casting, then, first of all, how large is your cast? And how does one cast when you are casting actors to portray more than one character? It seems to me like that gets to be a very complicated challenge for you.
Yeah, it's actually awesome. I love that from a directorial point of view. But we have a cast of 16 actors, ranging from first-year brand-new students to the program to seniors, accomplished students. The fun part for me as a director is working with actors on – seeing how much they can transform from one character to the next. So most of our actors play four or five characters in the play. And so in the audition and callback process, some of the things I was looking for is, are you able to transform your body, your voice, to portray a variety of characters? I think for some of our actors, this was a little bit new and scary, to put yourself out there and try to compose a character out of nothing for maybe somebody who stays on stage for 30 seconds or so. but it's exciting. And that's really where the spectacle of the production is in this ability for these actors to transform back and forth between different characters and creating believable portrayal of these real people. We had conversations early on with the cast about not trying to imitate the people that are in the play, because some of these people, there is news footage from them. There are, with the internet today, you can pretty much find everybody. The responsibility was to create a genuine portrait of who these people could be, but not necessarily imitate these people. Because most of our audience is going to come see the show and will not have an actual idea of what these people look like or what they sound like. So we did a lot of work about freeing the actors to make decisions about how this person would talk, how this person would walk, sit, stand. So it's fun. It's fun for the audience, I think, to watch a group of actors transform very quickly from one character to the next to create this this portrayal of this entire city.
So I'm curious about the matter of set and also of costumes. Let's talk first about costumes, since we were just now talking about the cast. So to what extent will the actors be going in and out of different costumes? How much will costuming impact the portrayal of these various characters?
Very little, as little as possible. In fact, I'm constantly editing out costume pieces. The goal is to really take advantage of the actor's ability to transform physically, vocally, to create the characters and not distract with extra pieces of costume and not rely on the costumes too much to bring these characters to life. So there are a few pieces here and there, but it's very minimal on purpose. That is also reflected in the scenic world for this play, because the goal, well, the play, I think if I remember correctly, describes the set as an empty theater or something like this, or an empty stage. So already you have the playwright's take on what this should look like. And so we've tried to somewhat embrace that. The alley configuration really serves that, in fact. And so we have a great original scenic design by Jody Sikis, who's one of my colleagues, who has created a very pared down, very conceptual set for the presentation of this play. There is a lot of spectacle with lights. Our lighting designer, Jessica Baker, who's an alum from the program, has helped create transitions between these different scenes in a way that feels like a big reshuffle. That was one of the words that we talked about in the production process, is how do you go from each of the scenes and each of these characters to kind of go to something completely different, a different part of town, different characters. And so this word reshuffling was important to us. So we have very dynamic lighting and sound transitions in the play. And the sound design is original music by Kevin Gray, who's one of our faculty in the music department.
Fantastic. So tell us about the students who are in this cast in terms of their prior awareness of the story of Matthew Shepard and the existence of this thing called the Laramie Project. I suspect some of them knew something about this, maybe even some of them knew a lot about it, and I suspect some of them came to this in a sense as neophytes, not really knowing anything about this story or why this play needed to be written.
The reality is all actors in the cast were not born when this event happened, which is interesting to think about. There's a bit of education that has to be done when we get this cast of actors in the room talking about what actually happened. educating them on the facts of the story, and then talking to them about the Laramie project itself, like what's that process was like and why it was presented, and also the legacy. Dennis and Judy Shepherd, who were Matthew's parents, have created the Matthew Shepherd Foundation, which has become a big advocacy group that's been lobbying for LGBTQ rights around the country. And so there's a legacy to Matthew Shepherd's attack and death that that is important today, and that actually impacts our students today, because we have a lot of LGBTQ students in the theater department and at UW Parkside in general. And these students, in fact, in some way, live in the legacy of Matthew Shepherd, and they may not know that. Hmm.
So for someone who's never seen the Laramie Project, they could well imagine this being, in a sense, a really heavy, difficult slog. And I mean, I for one don't see it as that. I mean, and it's probably important for us to underscore the fact that that for as tragic as this story is at its heart, that there is, in a sense, more to it than the tragedy in terms of what it's like to experience this over the course of an evening. Explain what you think of as kind of the overall atmosphere and maybe texture of this play.
Yeah, I'm so glad you are asking, because maybe one of the most misunderstood part of that play, of that text, of that experience, is that it is a very heavy, very serious play. And in fact, because the portrayal of these characters is so diverse, there's a lot of humor in the play, which is necessary, because no audience member wants to suffer for 2 hours in deep grief. And so the humor comes from the various takes on people's reaction and what they want to communicate to these interviewers, to the people from Tectonic who came and interviewed them about their own experience, their own life in Laramie. And so there are quite a bit of characters who bring a form of humorous take on themselves, really. And that's really important, because it helps us also see that human nature is not just dark, that people have a mechanism to look forward and to find ways to, I think, as a community, to rebuild. And so that aspect of the play, I think, is also what attracts me to the script, is that it is a play about making a better society, being a better society, being a better person. And that speaks to everybody. You don't need to be in Laramie, Wyoming to embrace that. And I think, here in Kenosha, with the events that happened a few years ago, we have a similar experience where we are constantly rebuilding our own community and thinking about our own community in a way that's maybe more proactive, or maybe more conscious about the way we look at ourselves. So I can see parallels about how our own community, the people around us, are maybe engaged in a similar process today.
Hmm. Very well put. So what has this experience been like for your young actors, grappling with this story and the events of which, as you just pointed out, happened before any of them were born? What has this experience been like for them, emotionally especially?
Yeah, I'll just say it, we're having a great time working on this production, because I think the actors are finding a lot of freedom in the process of creating these characters and telling this story. They're feeling empowered by the message of the play and by our ability to present the story on our stage. And maybe that's why some of these students chose to be in the performing arts, because you get to have a voice, you get to be maybe an advocate for a better community. And so the actors, yes, sometimes it's a little bit emotional. You're working on, I'm thinking Dennis Shepherd, Matthew's dad, has a long monologue in the final act of the play following the trial. And that monologue is very emotionally intense. And the actor who portrays Dennis is Colton Smith, who's a graduating senior. And he's done a lot of work to work through this very intense monologue to be able to do it justice and to be able to present it in a way that our audience can connect with. So it's a great experience. I think it's a lasting experience. Last time I directed this production, I think the cast after the run of the show would admit that this was maybe the most moving piece of theater that they had constructed together. And there's a strong sense of ensemble when you're working on a piece like this. So, you know, for young artists, I think it may be almost like a milestone in their education and in their career, as a moment where they engage in socially, politically conscious theater making.
So the play opens on October 13th, Friday, October 13th. We hope it's a lucky day, actually, despite October, Friday the 13th, and runs that weekend and the following weekend as well, both evening and daytime performances. If people are wanting to attend, what should they do?
They can go to wp.edu and search for theater performances, and they can buy tickets online or at the box office on the UW Parkside campus.
And I'm assuming this is taking place in your Black Box Theater?
Absolutely. Black Box Theater in the Rita Performing Arts Center.
Right. One of the most amazing black box spaces I've ever seen. And so some terrific things have occurred in that space, and I know this will be yet another. The Laramie Project, running the next two weekends at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And the director, Fabrice Conte-Williamson, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about this powerful play and your production of it, and best wishes to your whole cast and crew.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview from The Morning Show Archives. I cannot recommend highly enough a marvelous novel called Orphan Train, based upon the astonishing and often troubling story of the actual orphan trains that ran through the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century. Christina Baker Klein has done a superlative job of bringing this experience to life for us, and also of weaving a most intriguing connection between that story of many decades ago with a current story of a young woman caught in the foster care system. And there are some remarkable parallels which make this novel even more imposing and affecting to us. Again, the novel is Orphan Train. It's a paperback now from William Morrow. And Christina Baker Klein, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
My understanding is that you, almost by accident, came across references to the so-called orphan trains. Tell us about how that happened.
Yeah, I had never heard of the orphan trains before. And in fact, I've been astonished to find that most people don't know about the orphan trains. About a decade ago, I was visiting my husband's family in Fargo, North Dakota, of all places, and his mother had a book of, it was sort of a centennial celebration of a small town called Jamestown, North Dakota, and her father, so my husband's grandfather, was featured in an article on the orphan trains. He was one of six children orphaned and sent on a train to this little town of Jamestown, North Dakota. As I researched, I was curious, I'd never heard of it before, and I learned that over 200,000 children were sent on these trains. And as I researched it, I discovered that, in fact, his grandfather wasn't on an official orphan train, which those only came from the East Coast to the Midwest. His grandfather had been on one that went from the Midwest to the Midwest. But it started me on this journey, and about 3 years ago, I began really researching it and then writing the book that became Orphan Train.
It's a marvelous novel, and I have to say that when I discovered that you had constructed a novel with sort of parallel lines, parallel stories, this is before I'd actually read the novel, I have to say I was a little bit skeptical. I wondered how that would work, and in fact, I think it works brilliantly. But what a complicated challenge you set for yourself as novelists to write, in a sense, two compelling stories and weave them together. What prompted you to do that?
Well, I agree with you. Sometimes when I pick up books that have two stories, I think, oh, God, you know, I don't want to go back and forth. And also, one story is often more compelling than the other one. So
right.
You think, oh, can I just get through this section and get back to the story I really care about? My goal in writing the novel was to tell two stories that were equally compelling, and also that at a certain point, as you know, they connect and the stories become one. But I knew that I wanted to tell the story of what had happened on an orphan train to a character. And in fact, everything that happens to my character is something that really happened in real life. I did a lot of research, as I said, and I it was extremely important to me to get the facts exactly right, because I owed it, I felt, to the people who had really ridden on these trains, some of whom are still alive, and also to their 2 million descendants, who I knew would be looking at it, with going through it with a fine-tooth comb. And I wanted to be as accurate as possible with this backstory, the story of the trains. But I also wanted to tell a present-day story that kind of mirrored the trains. And in the present-day story, there's a girl who's 17 years old who's been in the foster care system. And she goes through as many kinds of experiences as the train rider goes through, and they're able actually to connect on that level as people who've had traumatic childhoods and have been put into homes where they weren't welcomed. So it felt to me like there was an emotional journey that the characters went on separately and together that echoed from one story to the next.
I couldn't agree more. One moment when we have just met this latter-day character, the teenage girl named Molly, who is in a foster home. I think it's her 9th or 10th, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, exactly.
Over the course of not that many years. At one point when she's sort of thinking about her own situation and the latest trouble that she is in or likely to get into, she thinks to herself, if there is one thing she hates most about being in the foster care system, it's this dependence on people you barely know, your vulnerability to their whims. She has learned not to expect anything from anybody. I mean, that is such a sad situation. And of course, it is all too real for too many young people.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other night, actually, I gave a presentation to about 60 social workers, and we were talking about exactly this, that the orphan trains don't run anymore, and it was conceived of as a really kind thing, and I can talk about that, but it ended up, of course, in practice being problematic, very problematic. But the truth is that foster children today experience many of the same feelings that the train riders experienced then, because they don't have any control over where they go either. The difference being that today there are all kinds of regulations in place to help children, and at the time there were absolutely none. There were no child welfare laws, no child labor laws. There was no welfare system at all, and so children fell through the cracks. And they were considered property, in fact. So today you hope that children in foster care have access to much better sort of checks and balances. But it doesn't always work that way in practice.
That the story of the orphan train is of a young girl who is orphaned when she loses her entire family in a very tragic fire. In the slums of New York City.
Yeah.
And I think you also do a wonderful job of helping us sort of understand what that kind of experience would be like for a young girl. At one point, this young girl is thinking to herself, my mother and father, two brothers and a sister, as dear to me as my own self. There is no language for my loss. And even if I find words to describe what I feel, there is no one to tell. Everyone I am attached to in the world, this new world, is dead or gone. It's astonishing to think about a young child facing that kind of deprivation and that kind of aloneness.
Yeah, so in 1853, this Methodist minister, Charles Loring Brace in New York City, realized that there were all these children. There were 10 to 30,000 children living on the streets of New York at any given time during this 75-year period, because, again, there were all kinds of reasons for it, but, you know, the country was being flooded with immigrants. Immigrants thought it was the land of milk and honey, and the streets were paved with gold, and, you know, they had this very idealized view of what America would be. And then they got here, and jobs were hard to come by, tenements were crowded, the child mortality rate was high, birth control was unavailable or not being used, and so there were many children in these families that couldn't support them. And children ended up on the streets, abandoned, taken out of homes, and orphaned. And those are the children who ended up on these orphan trains. And you know, Charles Loring Brace, the minister who came up with this idea, thought it was sort of a fresh air fund, like, let's send children to the beautiful Midwest where they can have, you know, air and live a healthy lifestyle and be in families, be brought up with religion and things like that. Of course, it didn't always work out that way, and I would say most of the time it didn't quite work out that way. But the impulse was originally a positive one, to take care of the children. It's just that when they were sent out, you know, look at the years that it happened, 1854, slavery was just ending, and so there was a great need for labor. And again, children were seen as property, and that there were no child welfare laws, so children worked, and they were expected to work, poor children. So they went into these homes, and they really were expected to work. They weren't, many times they were not adopted. They were called indentured, or so it was really a form of indenture.
Hmm. And, of course, one of the attitudes in terms of the Children's Aid Society is they felt like they were not only helping out these orphans, but in a sense, helping them rewrite their lives in a way that would be better than it would have been. When we first see an orphan train, I mean, the first scene that's actually on the orphan train, just as it's about to leave, Mrs. Scatcherd, who is one of the workers with the Children's Aid Society, is announcing to the children, "They call this an orphan train, children, and you are lucky to be on it. You are leaving behind an evil place full of ignorance, poverty, and vice for the nobility of country life." And
exactly.
And of course, the thing that's so interesting is, I mean, that attitude, and in a sense, the attitude of some of these families out in the heartland, who also, in a sense, one way or another, came to view these children similarly as coming from terrible places and probably bearing the scars and ill-behaved, not understanding the proper values of life. I mean, in a sense, those attitudes entrenched themselves so quickly that the situation was almost set up to fail.
You know, so many reasons that you've articulated are, yes, it was set up to fail. In addition, many of the children did not look like Midwesterners. They came from Eastern Europe. They might have been dark-haired. Redheads were not wanted. They were, the Irish, as you know, were discriminated against in our country for a long time. At the time of the orphan trains, Irish children were not wanted, considered lazy and all of that. And redheads in particular were definitely not wanted, and they were often sent back. So there was a period of time that the orphan trains ran that redheads were not allowed on the trains, which I thought was fascinating. I have two redheads. I'm part Irish, and my father was a redhead as well. So that resonated for me very strongly. And also, you know, these children, a number of them had accents, or some of them didn't speak English. They had come through Ellis Island oftentimes, and then terrible things had happened to their families, as happened to a lot of immigrant families, and they just fell through the cracks. You know, they were called orphan trains, but fewer than half of the children on them were orphans. They were abandoned and taken out of homes and runaways.
Mm. And one of the most touching things that we hear is that the train would make its first stop. Certain children would be chosen right then and there, and those that were not chosen would remain on the train as it proceeded to the next stop and to the next stop. And then at some point, of course, the orphan train would return to New York City, sometimes with children on it, where there was simply no interest in them. It's hard to imagine what it would feel like to be one of those children.
I actually talked to a number of train riders who had, you know, not been chosen first, and it was just a devastating feeling. And you were trying so hard to be chosen. You know, it's interesting, this I spoke to a group, I think I mentioned I spoke to a group of social workers the other night, and in foster care, there's a similar thing that happens now. I live near Newark, New Jersey, and there's a day, one day a year, when the children dress up in their best clothes, or clothes are bought for them, and they have to kind of impress people. They have parties with the children, kind of talking, and some are chosen and some aren't. And oftentimes the older children are not chosen, and it's just very hurtful to them, as you can imagine. But for the orphan train riders, actually, the older boys between 10 and 14 years old were the most popular because, of course, they were labor for the farms. The least popular were girls of the same age, as I mentioned in the book, because they were often considered a threat to the woman of the household, which, unbeknownst to them, they sometimes were, and also because they had to live in the home and not, like, in the barn. And so it was just fascinating. Babies were also popular because, of course, you could take a baby in, and the baby never needed to know that he or she had been on an orphan train.
Mm-hmm. You know, one moment that I'm so glad is part of this book is actually comes at the moment when this young Irish girl is taken out of her first placement and into another, that family decides they really don't want him anymore. And as a certain Mr. Sorensen is driving her to the next destination, to the next family on this journey, she thinks to herself, I feel almost sorry for Mr. Sorensen on our drive. I can tell this weighs on him. It's probably not what he thought he was signing up for when he agreed to be an agent for the Children's Aid Society. It is really easy, tempting to demonize those who put this orphan train situation together and who dealt with these children, it would seem, in sometimes very, very harsh fashion. And yet that comment points to something else, that at least in some cases, these were people with a genuine concern for these young orphans.
Yeah, I mean, Charles Loring Brace, who started it, had a genuine concern. And many of the people who were involved also had a genuine depth of feeling for the children. There were just so many children with nowhere to go. It was a real problem. And you know, it wasn't until the federal government got involved, which is partly why the trains stopped running, that child welfare laws made a difference. But for a long time, individuals trying to make a difference couldn't do much. There were just way too many children who needed help and not enough people to help them.
Mm. It's a very powerful, poignant story, and the way that it ties in the orphan train situation and experience with those of who are in the foster system today is a truly remarkable parallel that many of us would never stop to consider. And I commend you, Christina Baker Klein, for crafting such a beautiful, powerfully affecting novel, Orphan Train, from William Morrow. Thank you so much for writing this book.
Oh, I loved the interview. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Maggie Burke, who is the director of choral activities at Carthage College and will be on the podium Thursday evening for the fall choral concert at Carthage. That concert is also going to include a very special guest performance by one of the world's most renowned vocal ensembles specializing in early music, Stile Antico, all the way from Great Britain. And I'll be speaking tomorrow not only with Dr. Burke, but with also James Arthur, who is a bass with Stile Antico. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. On Thursday, we'll preview the upcoming concert of the Racine Symphony Orchestra with their executive director, Jonathan Winkle. On Friday, we'll shift from music to football, and you'll hear my conversation with Irving Muchnick, who is the author of a new book called Without Helmets or Shoulder Pads, in which he uncovers a really disturbing trend, an increasing number of deaths that occur not during football games, but actually during conditioning drills. And he has done investigative reporting on a number of different issues. This is the latest. And by the way, this coming Monday, the 16th of October, we'll be previewing the next concert of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. And you can also hear the morning show in podcast format through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Look for